originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 201, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he won the Kentucky Derby in 1950 aboard Middle Ground, becoming the second apprentice in history to do so. They won the Belmont that year as well, and he won the Belmont again 16 years later with Amberoid. He was a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award and inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2006. With 2,049 wins and over $14 million in earnings, it's a pleasure to introduce jockey Bill Boland. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Pleasure to have you on, Bill. You have such a great story. And, Bill, you got an early start to working with horses. I read that you started working with horses when you were 7 years old.
Yeah, I had my own horse when I was that age.
You had your own horses.
I worked at a rodeo grounds in Corpus Christi, Texas. And I used to get up every morning at 6 and go and take care of the cowboys' ponies, then go to school, and then come back and work more. So I've been riding for a long time.
Busy at a very young age. So you grew up, you're born and raised in Corpus Christi, Bill. And
Right. Tell
us about your family life. Do you have any brothers and sisters?
I have one brother and 2 sisters. And as of now, they're all still living, so we're doing pretty good. We're getting up there, but we're still hanging in.
I love it. And did your parents, did they work with horses at all?
They both rode, but, pleasure horses.
So they didn't have anything to do with the racetrack then?
No.
Well, I heard that your mother was actually a big part in introducing you to the folks at King Ranch.
Yes, she was. We moved from Corpus down to a place called Iola Beach. It's about 19 miles from the King Ranch. And she worked at a fish restaurant. And one of the head veterinarian from the King Ranch, Dr. Northway, used to come there every Sunday for fish. And she got to know him, and one day she said, I've got 2 boys, and they can both ride, and they're light. How about giving them a chance to go to work for the King Ranch? So he says, we'll bring them over, and we'll see what we can do. So about a month later or so, we went to the King Ranch and met with Dr. Northway, and we both went. They had the training center in town at that time for the thoroughbreds. So we went there, and my brother stayed about 2 weeks, and he got homesick and went home, and I stayed. And we broke the yearlings and were training them. They had a nice little track there. And then the following March, they loaded up 40 head of 2-year-olds, and we went to New York on a train. It took us 8 days.
Wow.
I was the dirtiest man you ever saw when we got off.
Wow. How old were you when you started working for King Ranch?
I was, I think I just turned 14. I was supposed to have been 16, but I lied about my age.
Yeah, I heard you forged your birth certificate.
Yes, I did.
One way to get an early start.
That's right. Well, you know, when you got to New York, you had to be 16, and you had to have working papers. So I was only 14, so I forged my birth certificate like a year and a half to make me 16, you know. My boss didn't even know how old I was after I'd won the Derby until I had bought a insurance policy, and they needed somebody to sign for it, so they sent it to him because he was like the legal guardian at that point. I was on the contract to the ranch, and he found out my age. So he called me in, and he bawled me out. He says, you know, I could get in a lot of trouble, and they can take away all the purses that you won when you were underage. So I told him, I said, well, if you won't say anything, I won't. He was a little mad, but he got over it.
Yeah, by the time you were 16, you'd already won the Kentucky Derby, so you got a head start to everything there.
Right.
So when you're at the King Ranch and you're breaking these 2-year-olds as a young boy, did it come easy to you? Did you have this natural athletic ability?
It came natural. You know, I'd been around horses and could ride. And when I started at the rodeo grounds there in Corpus, I didn't have a saddle, so we rode bareback, everything, you know. So there was no problem. The only thing with the thoroughbred, you had to jack your stirrups up, you know, and I wasn't used to that. But I got used to it.
Yeah, riding those horses at the rodeo bareback, that'll teach you how to stay on for sure.
That's right.
Now, when your brother left, that had to be hard for you being away from your entire family. He was gone. Did you experience any kind of homesickness?
No, not really. I loved what I was doing, so it kept me kind of happy.
What did your parents think of this idea?
What did they think of it? They thought it was great, you know. I was doing what I wanted to do, and they were supposed to send us to school. That was part of the contract, that they would put me through high school. And the funny part, we had two boys from Brooklyn were down there, so they sent us, the three of us, together. And one of the boys made a pass at the teacher, and that was the end of our schooling.
Oh, no. No more of that, more time to ride. So
no.
When you arrived in New York, that had to be a big culture shock, I'm sure, going from the ranches in Texas to the big city of New York. And was that a big adjustment for you?
Yes, it was. I wasn't used to subways and all that kind of stuff. So, and going to New York City and see these big, tall buildings, the roof of my mouth got sunburned from looking up.
When you started riding, Bill, the jocks room in New York, did anyone take you under their wing and show you the ropes?
Not really. When I went to work for the ranch, they had their contract rider for Max Hirsch was Warren Mertens, who won the Triple Crown for him on assault in 1946. And when he left, there was a jock called Dave Gorman came, and he was the older rider, and I was the apprentice. And he taught me more than anybody. But he didn't really take me under his wing. You know, he saw me doing something, he would try to help, you know.
What did you struggle with in the beginning?
Not much of anything. You know, it kind of come easy to me, you know. I could leave the gate good, and I could gallop a lot of horses. I was pretty good on a horse. Pretty good exercise boy.
Your first victory came on May 13th, 1949 at Belmont Park aboard Safe Arrival. Do you remember that race?
Pardon me?
Do you remember that race?
Oh, sure, yeah. He was it was the first horse that I'd got on that would be favored in the race. You know, I'd ridden about 13 horses before that. And, you know, they were long shots, and I was, you know, just trying to get used to it. And he was the first one that really had a shot that I rode. And he was a horse that liked to come from off the pace. And he was in so light that he just went to the lead and kept the lead all the way around, mile and 16th. Yeah. And he was favorite, so, but he won easy.
You said he was in light. Obviously, the weights have changed a little bit since then. How light were you tacking as an apprentice?
Well, when I first started riding, I weighed about 101 pounds. Stripped, you know. And so that means that I could do about 106. And if I had to, I could do a little bit lighter. I wouldn't eat the day before, and I could do 105, 104.
Was it hard for you maintaining that weight throughout the years?
No, I never had a whole lot of trouble with weight, no. When I got married, my wife put me on the Atkins diet. She didn't know it was the Atkins diet, but all we had was steak and eggs and high protein. No bread, no potatoes. So she kept me pretty thin.
When did you meet your wife?
I met her in 1950, right after the Derby, and then I went to California that winter. And we come back and we got married in next July.
How did you meet her?
Pardon me?
How did you meet her? Was she at the racetrack?
No. She lived not too far from the racetrack, but we were... I went bowling one night, and she was with a couple of her girlfriends in the next lane, and they were bowling, and I looked at her, and I said, that looks pretty good to me, and I took her home that night, and then we got friendly. Then that winter, I went to California, and the next year, we got married.
And the rest is history. Jockey Bill Boland joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Bill, after that first winner, did the wins just keep piling up? Did it come easy for you from then?
Well, I did fairly well the rest of the year after that. And then I went to California that winter at Santa Anita. And I wound up fourth leading rider. I think Shoemaker and Longdon. And I figured who other Arcaro elected. And I was right behind him in fourth, so I did pretty good. That's where I really learned to ride, really, when I went to California that winter.
Why is that?
I don't know. It just, things just kind of clicked. I was getting on better horses and riding a lot more. And, it just came.
Now, were you?
Come to think of it, you know, we're married 67 years.
Wow.
That's a long time.
That is a long time, Bill. That is a long time. I love it. That's fantastic. I've talked to your wife on the phone. She sounds like a wonderful person.
She is. Can be tough on me, but she's nice.
She keeps you in line.
That's right.
So, Bill, in California that winter, you mentioned some great names, Shoemaker, we've talked about Arcaro, just some great jocks back in the day. Who, in your opinion, besides yourself, was the greatest jock of that time?
Well, I think Arcaro was. was for a long time. And along came Shoemaker. He was for a long time. And you had Angel Cordero, Lafitte Benkei, Jerry Bailey. There's been some, you know, in their time, they were the best. But I guess all around, I guess Arcaro probably was. He was more, he was looked up to by me anyway, more than the rest of them. He was a picture on a horse.
Well, so are you, Bill. Alan Jerkins said that when you were watching the stretch run and two jocks dueling it out, giving it their all, he said, or between Arcaro and yourself, he couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, that was nice of him.
That's something. That's something. How would you describe your riding style?
A lot like Arcaro.
And for those who don't know, how was that? Were you more of a come-from-behind rider, more of a speed rider?
It didn't matter, really. If it's a matter of, you know, the horse and how he'd like to run. It didn't matter to me, the front, middle of the pack, or come from last. It was all up to the horse.
As long as they win, right? Doesn't matter.
That's right.
Now, Bill, let's talk about King Ranch for a minute. Were you under contract with them your entire apprenticeship then, and did you continue riding for them?
I was under contract with them for 5 years.
For 5 years. So yeah. Today, we don't have contracts.
No.
And we've talked to a couple riders here who've described them a bit. So what was your experience like being under contract? Would you get paid for every race you won, or how did that work?
Well, what they did with me, I had the 5-year contract, you know. They didn't pay you a whole lot of salary, but it didn't matter if you're riding, you know. But actually, if I hadn't have been on the contract, I'd have probably done a lot better, you know, after I'd won the Derby. You know, because you're really in demand if you have to win that. And when you're working for a stable like that, you can't ride against them. So if they got a horse in the race and I couldn't ride him, or if I could get a better horse, I couldn't ride against him, you know. So it has its ups and downs.
So do you...
Without the contract, I probably wouldn't have left Texas. I'd have probably still been there.
So do you think it's a good thing we don't have contracts these days?
Well, it's ups and downs, you know. I think there's a lot of people abused it, and some didn't, you know. But it would keep you in for, you know, just as a cheap exercise. Boy, if you're under contract, they didn't pay you a big salary, so they'd keep you in there working, you know.
So, Bill, let's take a minute now to talk about Middle Ground. Your first Derby. Your first Kentucky Derby victory. And when did you start getting on this horse, and did you know you had something special from the beginning?
Well, when he came up from the ranch, I was getting on him every morning before he even run. And in fact, I broke his maiden at Belmont Park. And then I didn't get to ride him again until his 3-year-old year. Because Dave Gorman was the older rider, the journeyman rider. And that year, he'd won the Hopeful, and I think he was second or third in the Arlington 2-year-old classic out there. So, and then Dave Gorman, for some reason, he left. And then I was the older rider, you know, so... Even though I was the apprentice, when I left California and came back to New York, I was leading rider in New York at Old Jamaica. And the week before the Arcaro had the mount on him if he wanted it, but he took a horse called Hill Prince over him, who was probably better than Middle Ground, and he he was kind of left open, and I was doing so good that it was would have been hard for them to take me off, you know, in the Derby, because I was really on a roll. And the week before the Derby, I won a big stake for the King Ranch, the Gallant Fox Handicap at Jamaica. And then we went to Kentucky, and I won the Oaks the day before on a filly called Arizmona. And then the next day I won the Derby. So I was on a roll.
I'd say so. That was quite a week for you.
Yes, it was. And then the following Monday, I won the opening day stakes at Belmont. Two-year-old stakes.
What a rush. Arizmona, what was she like to ride?
Well, she was a speed filly. I never saw her until I got there, and the owner came to the barn the day before the race, and he asked Max Hirsch, would it be all right if he put me on the filly? And he said, absolutely. And she was a speed filly. She just went to the lead and never looked back.
Well, I know as of 2012, she held the Oaks record at a mile and a 16th distance. And
yeah.
you yourself, Bill, were just one of seven jockeys to win the Oaks and the Derby in the same year.
Right. So I was probably the youngest
most
to win the Oaks. I know I was the youngest to win the Belmont.
Well, just the second.
I think in the 1800s, there was a couple of jocks that were that won the Derby. They were like 15, I think. Yeah, I was the youngest in this century, in the 19th century.
And just the second apprentice to win the Derby. So, Bill, when entries came out for the Derby, what did you think of your chances with Middle Ground?
I thought he did. Had a real good chance. He ran in the trials the Friday before, and the Saturday before, whatever it was, and they come up real sloppy, and he wasn't really a real good off track horse. He'd run all right, but not his best. And there was a horse called Black George or something like that, and he was a real speed horse. He was like 1-5 in the race, and he won by like 10 lengths. But Middle Ground was second, and he came out of the race real good, and I thought he had a real good shot going into the Derby, if he could beat Hill Prince.
If I remember right, during my research, Bill, I read that Middle Ground had never gone the distance before, had never gone a mile and a quarter or mile and an eighth before. Was that correct? He'd never gone that far of a distance.
No, well, no two-year-olds had gone a mile and a quarter. You know, that's the first mile and a quarter race of the year for three-year-olds. But and very few of them had won going a mile and 16th. I think a horse called Your Host had won going a mile and 16th in California. He was one of the choices. And Hill Prince had won the Wood Memorial. I'm not sure if they even called it the Wood. It might have been the Excelsior number two or something. But he had won that before the Derby, so he was favored. And I think Your Host was second choice. And then there was a couple of other horses. And then my horse was about third or fourth choice.
So take us through the race, Bill. How did it develop?
Well, my orders were was not to be within 10 lengths of the lead going the first turn, because there was a horse called Your Host was going to be in front no matter what. So, and they didn't think he'd get a mile and a quarter. So I was told to just, you know, kind of sit back and make one run. And I got lucky going the first turn. I got from 13 post position. I got down and I was on the rail going around the first turn, never lost any ground. And got through on everything, and we got about the 3-8 pole, and they had a chance to ease out, and they eased him out. Quarter pole, he went to the lead and held off Hill Prince.
At what point during the race did you know you had that race won?
When it hit the wire.
How far did you win by?
He won by about a length and a half. He probably should have won the Preakness. There was a horse called, there wasn't much speed in the race, and it was a short field, and instead of being way back, I was going to be up near the lead, and I was like a half a length off the lead, lapped on a horse called Mr. Trouble, and he didn't make the first turn. He took me right to the outside fence. Mm. By the time I got back and got down back in the race again, it opened up maybe 5 or 6 lengths, and he wound up beating me 4, so I might have beat him.
Hill Prince.
And then he went on, and he won the Belmont very easily.
Hill Prince, of course, ridden by Eddie Arcaro, as you mentioned, beat you in the Preakness, but didn't beat you in the Belmont.
No.
I read that was, you said that was one of the easiest races you've ever won.
It was. I never let him run maybe 70 yards.
He was quite a horse. What did he do after the Belmont?
What did Middle Ground do?
Yes.
Well, he got to run one more time, but I had broke my leg. So they ran, I think they ran him in Delaware or something, and Warren Mertens rode him. And then they kind of gave him a little rest, and they were bringing him back just before we went to Saratoga, getting him ready for the hopeful. And I worked him one morning 3/8 of a mile, and he broke his sesamoid. So that was the end of him.
We will continue our visit with jockey Bill Boland after this short commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanently Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined tonight by jockey Bill Boland. Bill, we just talked about Middle Ground and your history-making performance in the Kentucky Derby, and then the Belmont. And you won the Belmont 16 years later with Amberoid. And tell us a little bit about that horse, how you got the mount, and the race.
Well, I got the mount on Amberoid, and I rode him in the Wood Memorial, and he won that. And so then I had him for the Derby. And the Derby come up, it was a big field, and he had number one post, And when the man says go, he stumbled, put him out of position. He was like last going to the first turn. And he only got beat like 5 or 6 lengths. He ran a good race, but the post position killed him. And then he went to the Preakness, and he finished third. Koi King won. He won the Derby, and he won the Preakness. And then when we got to the Belmont, I wound up beating him in the Belmont, and I think Koi King bowed in the race. I think he once wound up second, but that was the end of his career. So he might have won the Triple Crown that year, but I got lucky and beat him in the Belmont.
Was that an easy win for you?
Pardon me?
Was it an easy victory? Did you win by many?
No, he only went by a length or so, but they tell me there's 2 or 3 horses in the race that should have beat him, but said they were in trouble, but I don't know. I was in front of them, so I don't know how true it was. But then I lost the mind on him, and I never rode him again after the Belmont.
How does someone take you off a horse when you win the Belmont?
Well, the trainer had an apprentice rider, a kid called Benny Feliciano, was coming around, and he was doing pretty good, and he was working for Lucian Lauren, and he started riding all of his horses. He was like a contract rider for him. Yeah.
I know Benny Feliciano. I'll have to give him hell for that. Let's talk about another special horse, Bill. Bo Purple, trained by Alan Jerkins. He was quite the racehorse. He actually was supposed to run in the Derby, but got injured. And then you two found great success together after his recovery. So tell us about that horse.
Well, Alan got the job with Jack Dreyfuss, who owned Bo Purple. And he brought, quite a few horses over in the stable, and I was riding them all. And I was riding all of Jerkins' horses. And Bo Purple, Alan didn't have one race under him. He worked him up to the race, and he won the Suburban, wire to wire, Brooklyn of the Suburban. I think it was the Suburban first. And he went to the lead and never looked back. And he was probably any horse that if he could get the first half mile, comfortable, relaxed, he could beat almost any horse. But if he had to force him the first half mile, then he would come up empty. He was, he had to get the first half mile relaxed, and then he could run all day. Good horse.
So the Suburban that year was really intended to be a match race between Kelso, the only horse since Whirlaway to be twice named Horse of the Year, and Carry Back, one of 4 horses in history at that time to win over $1 million. And then here you come, Bill, with this horse and beat them both.
Right.
And what were your odds that day? Do you remember?
He must have been 20-30-1. I don't know. I'm not sure what he paid.
Yeah, you teamed up with Alan Jerkins.
I know he wasn't one of the choices, that's for sure.
You and Alan Jerkins at that time were quite the team, the most successful trainer and jockey team in racing at that time, during that meet anyway. I mean, you guys had so much success together. You won his first stakes race.
Right.
And what was he like to ride for?
He was okay. He just thought everything that he run should win, but he was easy to ride for, but he wanted nothing. He liked speed horses. He liked the horses to be in front or positioned horses anyway. So most of my orders was put him on the lead or as close as you can, But that he trained for speed, so. And he was one of the best.
He actually spoke at the ceremony when you were inducted in the Hall of Fame.
Right, right.
That had to be a special moment. And let's talk about that for a minute, Bill. 2006, did you think that would happen? Did you know you were a possibility?
Well, I had been named a couple of times. I think three times before that and didn't make it, you know. They give it to some other writer at the time. And I'd kind of given up hope. And then I got a call from Saratoga, the museum, and they told me I had won. They said, sit down, relax. You just nominated to get to get it, so you got to come up here in August, which I was happy to do.
What a feeling that had to be to hear that, get that phone call, and hear that you were going into the Hall of Fame. And you also were a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award.
Right, right.
And given that that is an award where the winner is selected by their peers,
right,
I have to assume that was quite a sense of honor, of accomplishment.
Yes, it was. It was a great honor to get that. I look at that trophy every morning when I go from the bedroom to the kitchen.
Jockey Bill Boland joining us tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Bill, you beat Kelso with Bo
Who
Purple.
Makes that vodka? Did you? You said Sandman.
What was that, Bill?
Who makes the vodka? Sandman?
Tito's. Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Oh.
They're our sponsor here. I'll have to send you a bottle.
Okay.
It's good stuff. I like it. I will tell you.
Great.
But yeah, it's pretty cool to have a vodka company sponsor your radio show. I will say that. But but Bill, back to business. Bo Purple. You beat Kelso with Bo Purple, but you actually rode Kelso in his last career race, and the trainer was the brother of the first apprentice to ever win the Kentucky Derby. How about that?
That's
as a small
right.
world.
Yeah, that's right. It's a funny thing. I rode Kelso. They had laid him up for the winter, and they brought him back, and I rode him over at Monmouth Park going 3/4 mile when he was about six years old. So, and he finished second or third, I forget. And I guess they didn't like the way I rode him, and they took me off and they put Shoemaker on him, and Shoemaker didn't like him. He wasn't his type horse to ride. He's a kind of a horse you had to kind of keep riding all the way, you know. And they put Donald Pierce on him. Then they took him off, and they put Milo Valenzuela. And he rode him out the rest of his career. And then the last time he ever run was High Lear going 3/4 mile, and he was just all stoved up. And you know how the old age will get you, so. And he finished in the middle of the pack, but that was the end of him.
What was your opinion of him? I guess, as you mentioned, he wasn't at his best that race, and you had to ride him the whole way, but.
Yeah. He was a great horse. He was probably the best long-distance horse that I had seen up to that time. He could run a mile and a half, 2 miles. And he had some pair of lungs on him. Great horse.
Bill, besides the horses we've already mentioned, the great horses, Middle Ground, Amberoid, Bo Prince and Kelso, Bo Purple and Kelso, what if a highlight reel of your life, what would that entail? The great moments, the great horses, anyone else on that list?
On that list? Well, Secretary was great. I'd love to have rode him.
But that you personally rode?
Oh, that I personally rode. Well, I rode a horse called High Gun that beat the best horses in New York, best older horses, three and older horses. I only got to ride him one time, and he won the Sison B at Belmont, and he broke down in the race, and he never ran again. But he was a good horse. And I also rode Assault the last time he ran.
How about Sword Dance?
Sword Dance, yeah. He was a nice horse. I broke his maiden at Saratoga, and then I didn't ride him again until the three-year-old at the Derby. Shoemaker had to call on him, but he had given a call away, and he couldn't ride him. But I think it was set that if I rode him in the Derby, that Shoe would get him in the Preakness for the rest of the year. He was very close with the Birches, who trained Sword Dancer.
I'm guessing you weren't high on Bill Shoemaker after that Kentucky Derby.
Do what?
I guess that Kentucky Derby, Bill Shoemaker wasn't your favorite person after that Kentucky Derby.
No, we were good friends. That had nothing to do with it.
But that had to be a frustrating moment for you anyway, given
it was
the
worst moment of my life. Took me 6 months to get over it.
Wow.
But I went to Hollywood Park. I left New York and went to California to ride out the summer. And I did very well out there. So then I came back to New York in the fall at Saratoga and then finished out and stayed the rest of my career in New York. That was my home base.
What's your favorite racetrack, Bill?
Well, I guess Belmont. Belmont, usually the best horse can win there. You know, it's big, wide, sweeping turns. But I love Belmont Park. That was Max Hirsch had his stable there for the King Ranch, so I was there every day, you know.
Bill, eventually you decided to retire and start training horses.
Right.
And what led to
dumbest
that decision?
Dumbest thing I ever did in my life.
Dumbest thing. Oh, no. What made you...
pretty good. Yeah, pardon me?
What made you decide to do that?
Stupidity. I was up at Saratoga, and I was riding all the Jerkins horses, and he decided he was going to ride somebody else, and I wasn't doing very good at the time, so I got a little disgusted. And I always wanted to train anyway. I thought I would be a good trainer. And it did pretty good. First horse I trained won a stake. I bought a filly off of Woody Stevens called Native Fern. And for 15,000, she was running 15,000 claiming races. And I doctored her up a little bit, and I ran her in a non-winners of two other maiden claimants, but she was eligible to be a maiden, and she won that. And then the next start, she won the Demoiselle at Aqueduct. And then I trained another horse called, Wise Phillip. He won about 300,000 in New York. He won quite a few. He won seven stakes. So he was a pretty good horse.
Did you say that was the stupidest decision of your life? Why was that?
I should have rode another 10 years and set myself up better. You know, made contacts to set myself up to train. I didn't have an owner when I quit riding. I just quit cold turkey, and I had one guy bought a horse for me. And I couldn't even get stalls in New York. I had to borrow a stall from Alan Jerkins. Otherwise, I couldn't have even started training. They wouldn't give me a stall.
Sounds like a tough time starting out. How many horses did you end up with on a regular basis? How many horses did you train at once?
Well, I went anywhere from you know, because I never got going that good. I went from maybe 6 to, I got up as high as about 15. That was it. Never really got going. But it did pretty good for what I had.
Did you miss riding during that time?
Never did.
Never?
No. I didn't miss riding. I didn't miss training. When I went to work for, when I quit training, I went to work for the association, NYRA. And I really loved that. I enjoyed that as much as riding or training. I wound up associate steward, alternate steward. And I really enjoyed it. And they treated me nice, too. The NYRA treated me good. And I worked for them for 10 years and retired, and that's it. I moved to Florida to live in heaven. Played golf yesterday and won $40.
Can't
beat
that.
My wife's looking at me.
Bill, you said...
I wonder what I did with the 40.
Well, when you were training horses, would you gallop your own?
I started out going my own, and when I got up to like 15 horses, I couldn't gallop my horses and watch what was happening at the barn and everything. So I kind of give up the galloping the horses. But when I first started, I had like 10 horses. I was galloping all 10 of them.
Wow.
I went from, when I quit riding, I went up to about 100 and maybe 120, 125. And then when I started training and I was getting on all my horses, I went down to 105. I was working myself to death.
Back down to riding weight, bug weight.
Oh, yeah, I could have went back to riding easy. I should have probably, but I was dumb.
Bill, when you were training and you went to go look for a jock to ride your horses, what would you look for as a former jockey? What would you look for in a jockey? Would you look for someone who would help you out in the morning? What would you look for?
Well, not so much. I would, I was kind of a small guy training horses, so the jocks didn't come around my barn that much. But I would go to them and see... try to get the best rider I could. I'll never forget Angel Cordero. I had a horse in the last race at Aqueduct. It was in the fall of the year, and the jock I had took off because didn't want to ride, and Angel rode my horse, and he was like leading rider thing, and I really appreciated that he did that. All the jocks in the room, nobody wanted to ride the horse, and Angel said he would, so... He's a pretty good guy.
Angel's a great guy. Did he win the race?
No, but he ran very good. And he'd come back and he told me what I should do with him. And he was right. And I wound up winning the race with the horse. So.
Jockey.
He would always ride me if I went to him and said, I want you to ride this horse. And he won a stake for me. He won the Gallon Fox on Wise Phillip at Aqueduct. Going a mile and a half or something. So we made it up anyway. He's a great rider.
Jockey Bill Boland joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Bill, you said you enjoyed your time with NYRA just as much as you did training and riding. And you were an alternate steward and a patrol judge.
Right.
And which of those positions did you enjoy more?
Well, I enjoyed being a steward, but a patrol judge, it was natural. I knew what was going on. And then the last year I was there was a replacing judge because they brought a steward in to replace me, a fellow called Dave Hicks. And he wound up with a NYRA steward, so... I went up in the placing judge stand, but it was great. I didn't have to go to work till 12 and after the last race go home. So was very easy.
Sleep
Nobody
in.
Nobody bothered. They'd leave you alone. But I enjoyed it, because I knew what I was doing, you know, in the steward stand. And, you know, I'd been to all parts of the game. I went from the backside to the front side and rode. So it really came easy for me.
So to those who might not know, Bill, describe what a patrol judge and a placing judge do.
They don't have placing judges anymore. I mean, patrol judges anymore, do they?
I don't think so.
Not too many of them. I think they kind of did away with most of them. You still need the placing judge, though.
But what would they do?
What, the patrol judges?
Yeah.
Well, they'd set you, like in New York, we had one at the quarter pole, one at the half-mile pole, one at the start, and one at the finish. So you had four of them, so they were covered the whole part of the race. But, you know, and they would call in any infractions that happened in front of them. The stewards would say, what did you see, or whatever. And if you saw something, you would call it into the stewards, you know. So-and-so happened going by me at the half-mile pole, you know.
When you would do work as an alternate steward, I'm sure that was easy for you, given that you rode. And I'm a firm believer that of the three stewards, at least one should be a former jockey. So they
Well, they really should, but not all jockeys are make good stewards, I don't think. But they should have one in the stands anyway.
I've had conversations with friends who question why a jockey gets on the phone with the stewards following a claim of foul or an objection. And what's your opinion on that? Do you think that's necessary, or do you think that's not really needed?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with it. And he might be able to tell you something that, you know, that it really doesn't show up, you know. But they really don't need it, because they've got your cover from the time you leave the gate until you finish, so you know what's going on, you know. If you have people in the stands that knows racing and knows about riding, there's a fine line between race riding and going over the line, you know. You can race ride and not really foul, but you can come close. So you have to know the difference.
You were riding in an era, the greatest era of racing, in my opinion. And what have you seen? What changes have you seen since then? And are those changes good?
I think in my day when I was riding and doing good and all, I think you had great officials. You had stewards like Marshall Cassidy in New York. And he had his brother out in California. And he had some good stewards around Maryland and Jersey, you know. So I think that was good. Now it's gotten kind of political. And I don't know that it's any better or worse. You know, they can learn, but I would like to have somebody judging me that knew what they were doing, you know, more than coming out of the streets and being politically, you know, like state stewards. Most of them are political, and a lot of them are not racetrackers. They're just political appointees, you know. They know the rules, but they don't know what they're looking at. They learn, but in the meantime, a lot of things can happen.
We only have a couple minutes left here. I read that Middle Ground ran five times in a few weeks leading up to the Derby, and that's another change I've noticed, that horses These days, they take much more time in between races. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. It's the trainers that do. You know, they make up that date. But Max Hirsch was, he felt that the horse needed it. You know, he only ran a few times as a 2-year-old, so, and then he was laid up, and he come back, and he ran in a sprint race at Jamaica against older horses. And then he came back and ran against 3-year-olds, but there was a horse called Ferd in there. It was a speedball. And he finished second to him. He finished second to My Request. And then he ran him a mile and 16th, and he finished second to Hill Prince. Then he went to the Derby Trials, and he finished second.
Bill,
and then he went to Belmont.
We have about 30 seconds left here. I want to end on a fun note. How's your golf game lately?
Well, like I say, I won yesterday, so 85 and shooting 85, that's not bad.
Not too bad at all, Bill. You still work at the golf course?
No, I give it up.
Well, Bill.
No, I just go by, play 2 or 3 times a week, and that's it.
Can't beat that. Bill,
no.
Thank you so much for joining us. It has been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Wishing you all the best. Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.